Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 15th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. As my colleague Dennis Small discussed at some length last night on the weekly LaRouche Pack webcast, there have been a number of events in the last week which provide a real concrete indication of what is possible as we enter the post-Obama era. By post-Obama era, I'm not talking about something which begins in January 2017, but rather something which was inaugurated by the crushing defeat suffered by the Democratic Party due to the unpopularity of Obama last November 4th. This was not a great Republican victory. It was an indication that Americans, both those who voted and the much larger number of those who did not vote, are over ready to get rid of President Obama and his policies, which are destroying our nation. He must be impeached now. And while Obama was suffering such a decisive defeat in U.S. politics, he was completely isolated at this week's APEC summit in Beijing and at the ASEAN meeting in Myanmar, as the Chinese, as the leading nation of the BRICS nations, put on the table a breathtaking series of economic development proposals for cooperative technological advance, especially in areas of infrastructure, as well as developing a series of new funds to pay for it. These proposals, which China's President Xi stressed are open to the U.S. to participate, are based on a principle of inclusion, in contrast to Obama's counterproposal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, which would increase the power of financial and raw material cartels at the expense of sovereign nations, beginning with the exclusion of China. Instead of even considering the benefits of to a declining transatlantic economic and financial system by joining with the BRICS, Obama and his British Commonwealth allies are ramping up their rhetoric against Russia and China, preparing for World War III, rather than to allow this new potential for humanity to be realized. In commenting on this situation, Lyndon LaRouche sent a message to the webcast last night in which he said, and this is a quote from LaRouche, "There is a nice torrent developing, and we have to open the floodgates. The planet is ripe for sweeping change. We have to make sure," he continued, "that people understand the process that is underway, and that we are seeing the beginnings of a new world. Possibly a crushing of Satan's realm, and just in time." To help you understand this process, I've invited Michael Billington to be our guest today. Mike is a longtime leader of the LaRouche movement and has been working very closely with Helga Zepp LaRouche to organize support for the bold approach taken by the Chinese and to bring Western governments into support of this alternative, which is the only alternative to the British imperial policies pushed by Obama, which are destroying our nation. So, Mike, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
But to open, I'd like you to give our listeners a summary of last week's events at the APEC summit in Beijing and why Americans should welcome these developments.
Let me say one thing prefatory to that, which is that lest anybody believe that it was some sort of a victory for Obama to be crushed in the election, let me disabuse you of that fantasy, because it's a fantasy. What happened was that this nation is being taken over by a clinically fascist Republican leadership. It's exactly what we warned the Democratic Party. LaRouche could not have been more clear than telling the Democrats that unless they removed Obama from office last year, at least by last year, that they were going to face a disaster which not only meant the disillusion of the Democratic Party, but that this fanatic, warmongering, hysterical Republican leadership, which is more dangerous than Obama, committed to war. They've never seen a war they didn't like, people like McCain and others. As LaRouche said this afternoon in a meeting, he said, look, we have this tremendous potential from the BRICS, what China is doing and leading the way. And if this Republican group, this Republican leadership we have today, comes to power, they will go to war to destroy China and in that destroy civilization. So, I mean, we have to be very clear here that we take no joy in watching the demise of the Democratic Party. And it's still the case, as Harley just said, that Obama must be removed, not in the next election, God forbid, now, so that we can rebuild a sane group of both Republicans and Democrats capable of carrying out LaRouche's program, which is the only thing that can save this country.
Mike, let me, I just thought to amplify that point. Our listeners know that this is what Keisha Rogers' campaign for the Senate was in Texas, was to shift the discussion in the United States from the usual political traps, the hot button issues, into a discussion of getting rid of Obama and going to this new post-Obama era. And in her campaign, she was largely successful in doing that. The Republicans didn't really pick up on it. They used opportunistically all the damage Obama was doing, and that's what they intend to do until 2016. So I think the warnings from LaRouche, the success of Keisha's campaign, points the way in the direction that we're now seeing come into existence with the BRICS.
And in terms of what you asked me to do, it's clear that what Xi Jinping has done at APEC, and he's doing it again in Australia. I'll mention the update on what's going on there now at the G20. But he's basically reached out to you, to me, to us, this organization, and to the American people, and said, "Please join us. We welcome you." I just want to read this one paragraph. Dennis read this last night in the webcast too. But here's what he said at the final meeting, the leadership meeting of the APEC meeting in Beijing. He said, "I also introduced to President Obama China's initiatives of establishing the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Silk Road Fund. Underdeveloped infrastructure is the main bottleneck obstructing the economic development in Asia. China has initiated the AIIB in order to offer support and facility to regional infrastructure development. These proposals and initiatives are open and inclusive in Asia. They are not exclusive. We welcome the active participation of the United States and other relevant countries so that together we can promote and share prosperity and peace in the Asia Pacific." And note that he says the Asia Pacific. This is not just Asia. This is the Asia Pacific, which means the United States. It means all of the American countries in North and South America. And in fact, it means the whole world, as we've seen with the BRICS. So this is what's on the table. We have the offer. It's in our hands. The problem is, as both Harley and I have just said, the American people are being manipulated into absolutely insane pseudo debate. People are demoralized, they're scared, and they have no idea that this is going on in the rest of the world because the media here is simply not reporting the real world. And therefore, people are scared, they're frightened, they can't see any way out. They've lost the sense that America was a nation which, in fact, was innovative in the sense that we do things that are entirely new. That's what the founding of this country was. That's what John Quincy Adams did. It's what Lincoln did. It's what Roosevelt did. We created new institutions and overcame the British agents who have repeatedly destroyed this country or threatened to completely destroy it. And never has there been a time more urgent that we recognize that a small number of people with ideas who are capable of being creative have the capacity and must bring about this dramatic change here in the United States. And what I'll just do briefly, which again Dennis did last night also, and I did on the call on Thursday night to our organizers.
Well, for
is
those
just
who don't, you can go back to LaRouchePact.com and watch the webcast from last night, where Dennis does cover quite a bit of this. But I think it's important to make it clear that this is not just something that was a momentary presentation, but it's part of a longer-term drive. And Mike, you've been involved with this for the last several years, so I think you can bring that perspective here
Right.
to the listeners.
So, I mean, just look at what happened at that meeting and subsequent meeting in Myanmar of the East Asia group. They began the meeting. You may remember a month or so, a couple, well, several months ago, Russia and China signed an historic probably the biggest infrastructure deal in the history of the human race, a $40 billion plan to bring Russian oil by pipeline all the way across the far east of Russia down into the area around Beijing. They at the meeting this week, they signed a second massive oil deal, almost as big, where they're going to bring from the Siberian oil fields. In this case, they're not going to go across Russia and down into the Beijing area. They're bringing it straight down into Xinjiang, which is the far west province of China, which is the very poor area, mostly desert, but it's the springboard for the Silk Road. It's from Xinjiang that they'll be taking these roads out into Central Asia, down into the Arab world, and all the way up to Europe. So they're pumping this oil, which will take some time to build the pipeline, but it'll be basically creating the conditions for building up this region as a modern industrial area. They also announced an extra, a new $40 billion fund in addition to the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, $100 billion for general development. This is $40 billion for the Silk Road and the Maritime Silk Road development to build rail, ports, other kinds of infrastructure, water infrastructure. And in that light, Xi Jinping announced that they intend to triple their foreign direct investment to $1.2 trillion by the end of this decade, which is just 6 years from now. At the same time, South Korea and China signed a free trade agreement. This was a tremendous blow to Obama. Obama has been trying to hook Korea into a anti-China alliance with Japan and the Philippines and Australia. And the Koreans have resisted this because they recognize that their own future rests in the great development taking place in Russia and China. And they recognize the only hope for peace in Korea, with North Korea, is to, in fact, work with the Russians and the Chinese on the idea of peace through development, not Obama's...
Isn't he also trying to get the South Koreans in on the Asia pivot as a defense against so-called Chinese expansion?
Yeah, exactly. This is what I mean, this anti-China alliance that he's been trying to get them to accept high-altitude missile systems, which are useless to Korea. Their only purpose is to confront Russia and China, and the Koreans want nothing to do with it. So this was a blow where the Koreans basically said, sorry, Mr. Obama, that it's not our future. We choose progress over war and destruction, thank you. And, of course, there's this big fight. You've probably read about it. The Obama's been trying now for years, and started with Bush, actually, to impose something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a free trade deal with a select group of countries, China excluded, as Harley mentioned. But as most important, it's a direct attack on sovereignty. If you sign on to this TPP, you are giving up your right to control your economy in certain crucial areas to a group of bankers who will oversee your economy to make sure it conforms to this TPP. And that includes even the United States, which is why a lot of people in the U.S. want nothing to do with the TPP. If we sign it, we also lose some of our sovereignty, although what little we have left now that this country is basically, as LaRouche said, and I'll say it bluntly, this country is a piece of shit doing nothing of value to the human race at this point. And that would further destroy it. So Obama tried his best to prevent Xi Jinping from bringing up his idea of a free trade of the Asia Pacific, which would include all countries and would not impose conditionalities on nations, but do mutually beneficial agreements to facilitate trade without imposing restrictions on your own development. Obama forced them to not put it in the pre-draft of the final resolution, but in fact, which they didn't do, but immediately Xi Jinping brought it up and literally got standing ovations from everybody at the event. So that now is going forward. They have a study group to prepare it for the next 2 years. Then Indonesia, which was the only country in Southeast Asia which Obama had convinced not to join the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, not only met with Xi Jinping, the new president, Joko Widodo, met with Xi Jinping and announced that indeed they are going to join the AIIB. Then the last thing I'll mention here is that As I said, Japan and the Philippines have been the two countries which have played the game of confronting China. Japan threatening to remilitarize in the fashion of the 1930s and 40s Japanese fascist governments. And Obama, of course, pumping this up. And the Philippines, with a puppet president, has signed an agreement at the presidential level to allow the U.S. to literally take the Philippines over as one mass U.S. military base, obviously for a war with China. That's run into trouble in the Philippines, big trouble. And both Abe in Japan and Aquino in the Philippines began to see the writing on the wall that Obama's finished. He's through. They don't have this this massive force that, you know, this myth of massive force in Washington to back up their game playing with China. And seeing the writing on the wall and recognizing that their own economies, both Japan and the Philippines, were in total disaster, unlike the rest of Asia, which is leaping forward with these great projects. Both of them decided to tuck their tail between their legs, crawl off to Beijing, plead with Xi Jinping to have a meeting. He agreed to a meeting with Abe, but he's being very cautious. He wants to see if the Japanese are really going to stop this militarization or not. And in the Philippines, he was even more cautious, but basically those are both steps in the right direction. And then lastly, he went off to Myanmar for this ASEAN and East Asia summit and announced another $20 billion fund, again, for ASEAN countries involved in the Silk Road process. So this is extraordinary. This is just in a week. And there's other things going on around the world, in South America, rail developments in Africa, from the BRICS countries. So you've had within a period of 1 to 2 weeks what has to be described as an explosion of development, again, which the U.S., you know, unless you're reading LaRouche's material, unless you're reading the EIR and coming to the LaRouche PAC website, you'd have no way of knowing that this is even taking place.
You know, Mike, it's interesting because there are also a lot of people now who have come to be suspicious overall of what the too-big-to-fail banks are doing, and they don't like the IMF. But they're completely unaware of this, because on the one hand, you have the International Monetary Fund, which has stopped any effort at development and turned everything into essentially a debt collection. And here the Chinese are offering a completely different approach to development, and it's kept out of the U.S. press. It's almost, it is the Goebbels-style control of the media that makes the Americans pessimistic.
And here is the kingpin of the Goebbels in America, the Wall Street Journal, who reports on what happened at the APEC meeting. What do they have to say? They admit that China has launched something not totally unlike our Marshall Plan after the war, a plan for developing our friends and allies. It says, China's Marshall Plan, Xi Jinping bids to take leadership away from the U.S. And then goes on to accuse China of trying to, quote, out America the Americans. Imagine. I mean, this is literally saying they're doing what we, as a great nation, used to do. We have to stop them. We have to, and then they conclude. They say this new model, this is a quote, this new model suggests Chinese leaders want to resurrect the imperial tributary system. Imagine. So this is the kind of insanity being pumped into the American people. And it can only be defeated if we take reality, truthfulness, to those people in the form of what can and must be done, which is being offered to us. Let me put in a plug for this report, Harley, okay? Our report?
This is important.
We've been working all year long, starting in January. We hoped to have it done back in the spring, but it turned out to be a bigger project than we were thinking, and we now have completed, and we should have published within perhaps a week, a 350 or so page report called The New Silk Road Becomes the World Land Bridge. And this is much more than an update on the World Land Bridge report we did almost 20 years ago in 1996. This is a book, which a thick special report, which in a very real sense, when people say, when you have this in your hands, You're basically saying, here's what the human race is capable of achieving right now, not an imaginary future by and by. This is what's in our hands, largely because over a 40-year process, Lyndon and Helga LaRouche, with some others, but their critical role helped to create in China, in Russia, in India, and other places, this momentum for carrying out what the Wall Street Journal admits is the American system. We have the potential of taking that American system carried out by China and Russia and India, and in fact bring that home to this sad nation, this collapsing hulk, which has been so totally ripped apart, not only its physical infrastructure and our economy and our agriculture, but psychologically, socially, morally, torn apart, dumbed down, as many people now correctly say.
You know, I had Helga on the program last week, who went through the contrast you see between the optimism in China and the just resolute, stubborn pessimism and cynicism in the United States. So this report is available. You can get it through whoever you speak to at LaRouche PAC or in the LaRouche organization. It's also available, I think, through the Executive Intelligence Review, is it not?
Yeah.
The EIR website?
Yeah, it is. Well, I think the ad is up there, yes.
Yeah, we'll have that available. And this is something that will change your thinking about the world and about yourself. Now, Mike, you went through this whole question of what's been proposed, what's on the table. Now, we have the G20 that is going on right now in Australia, and preceding the G20 event was a meeting of the BRICS, the five core nations that are working with President Xi of China. And I'd like you to give us a report on what you know from that meeting.
Yeah, we're just getting these reports in, of course, because it's about 12 hours difference there. So it's evening there, and the first day is completed. I mean, there's obviously two things to report. One is that Obama is there with his sick allies from Europe, like Angela Merkel from Germany, this crazy woman who should have been thrown out long ago for destroying Germany, shutting down their nuclear, making war, bringing the war on Russia into Europe, allowing fascists to come to power in Kiev. Germany allowing fascism, in fact supporting this government, which is made up of several fascist organizations. But they were there to wreck it, to try to talk only about Ukraine, about Russia as the evil force, about global warming. You know, this was the great victory Obama had with Xi Jinping. He came back with a ridiculous agreement on global warming, which of course doesn't exist, and which the Chinese simply agreed to do what they have to do because of their serious pollution problem, which is to reduce the use of hydrocarbons, not because of carbon, but because of pollution, and they need more nuclear plants. Which is
well, and Obama's agreement, his side of the agreement, was to further destroy U.S. technology.
Further shut it down, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So you have on that side, I'll go through the negative first, but the positive is the much more interesting. Here's just one report I got from the Reuters coverage. You had the crazy Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who's been ranting about Putin now for months. Putin came up to him and extended his hand, and Harper said, "Well, I guess I'll shake your hand, but I only have one thing to say to you. You need to get out of Ukraine." And Putin apparently responded, "I'm sorry, that's impossible. We're not there." Obama personally said that Russian aggression against Ukraine is a threat to the entire world. He said that he said the United States is in the forefront of opposing Russian aggression against Ukraine, which is a threat to the world, as we saw in the appalling shootdown of the Malaysian Airlines 17.
Right.
Now, of course, there's absolutely no evidence that Russia had anything to do with that, and quite extensive evidence that it was done by the Kiev government. But that is just not allowed to be discussed. Everybody assumes that this evil force, Putin, is responsible. Well, I can assure you that the Malaysians do not believe that. And they are demanding that there be a real investigation, which has been prevented by the Ukrainian government shelling the region where this plane is. But that's another story. Merkel herself said, right there in Australia, she said, we're considering more sanctions. At present, the listing of further persons from Russia is on the agenda for a meeting that's going to take place Monday at the European Council. So these lunatics are trying to turn this into, instead of it's supposed to be a discussion about economic growth. And interestingly, the Australian government is playing a relatively sane role. Tony Abbott, their prime minister, said, we don't want to discuss global warming or strategic issues. This is an economic conference. The world economy is in a disaster. The Chinese and others are moving forward. We need to discuss how to get the world economy moving. Australia is trying to get a free trade deal with China. So something interesting is going on in this bastion of the British Empire. We'll see if it proceeds. So anyway, that's the lunatics. Now, what really happened is that Xi Jinping and Putin and Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, and Modi from India, and Mr. Zuma from South Africa had a meeting. The BRICS had a side meeting before the G20 to coordinate their policy. And Xi Jinping made it very clear that just as we took over APEC, took it away from these lunatics in the West, and invited them to join us in making it something productive, but they intend to do the same thing with the G20. They said there's two ways of the world is working now. One is economic cooperation. The other is isolation and warmongering. He made it clear that we have to come together worldwide in order to bring about a peace in the world. In other words, this economic development is not just good for economic development's sake. It's the only basis on which we can have peace. This, of course, has long been Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche's argument, like Pope Paul VI, who said that the new name for peace is development.
Actually, there was also a message along those same lines from the current Pope Francis to the G20.
Oh, I didn't catch it. What was it?
Well, what he basically said is that here's an opportunity to take up the question of justice for the poorer countries, and that this should be, he said, I welcome your deliberation on this. And that's his way of nudging the West, although I think Xi's way is a little bit more effective.
Well, yeah, it's good to have that ally. this has been an important papacy, actually, in this regard. And now that he has something to back, maybe it'll take even more power. So, again, she offered that, like we did in APEC, we're reaching out to the West. Before attending this meeting, Putin held a press conference in I think it was in Vladivostok, actually.
Yeah.
In which he also said, let's be honest, folks, there is no basis for development or peace if we try to do it alone. Now, this is very important because, as we've been saying from the beginning, and Mr. LaRouche has always made clear, this is what's happening with the BRICS, what's happening in China is the leading force in the world. We have to orient towards it. But if we fail in the United States, if this country goes fascist, then all of that is for naught. We have to do this together, which means the responsibility is in our hands here, and this organization literally has the responsibility for making this work. Lynn is quite concerned about the fact that we are not doing what we need to do to carry this through because we have little time. We have to have every single American think as if they were personally responsible for the future of mankind, because they are. It happens to be the case. What we do here in America is going to make or break whether we have World War III and perhaps the extinction of the human race, or whether we can unleash a great renaissance in collaboration with our true neighbors, the nations who have learned from America what the American system can do and are now carrying out that American system while we descend into a British imperial fascist insanity.
You're listening to Michael Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review and longtime associate of Lynn and Helga Zepp LaRouche. And this is the LaRouche Show for November 15th, 2014. We're taking up the question of the opportunity that exists if you can get out of the muck of U.S. politics. Now, Mike, you and I spoke very briefly before the program about one of the more difficult problems in organizing Americans. And I'd like to take that up from the standpoint that you've just laid out of the approach of President Xi and the BRICS, which is inclusive, which is the idea of cooperation, as opposed to the dog-eat-dog free trade policies of essentially the City of London going back to the British Empire and Adam Smith. And that is the image of China that most Americans have. You know, you can't open the newspaper without reading something about Chinese expansionism, Chinese threats to Vietnam, China threatening the Philippines, threatening Japan, threatening the United States. I even saw a story not that long ago, I think last week, about why does China want to build high-speed rail systems in Mexico to prepare for an invasion or a large-scale immigration of Chinese into the United States. So I'd like you to take this up because there's a whole history here that Americans don't know. But it's not only the current period we don't know, but we don't know the history of the American system idea in China. And I think that's really critical because if we don't take this on in the population, the Republican warmongers will, and they'll use the misinformation and delusion for a military buildup and more war. So I'd like you to take that up. We have plenty of time to discuss it, but I think this is really the critical issue for Americans.
Yeah, I think I'd like to go through this a bit. I thought about this because, you know, it's not the case that all of a sudden China got good. We're not trying to say that China was evil and bad and then it got good. We were fierce opponents of most of what happened under Mao and certainly the dark age of the Cultural Revolution, which I'm sure you've all heard about from the mid-60s through the mid-70s. And then Deng Xiaoping after Mao's death and Zhou Enlai's death took over and began the opening up process. And we've written a lot about that. It's worth studying it and seeing it. But it didn't come out of nowhere. There's a history of America's role in Asia and even within the Communist Party, in the person of Zhou Enlai. Some of the younger people on the call may not even have heard of Zhou Enlai. His name is not used much. But he was the key leader in China from the very beginning with Mao and a few others. But essentially, it was Mao and Zhou Enlai. And Mao was a mixed character. He had different tendencies that he tried to balance. And he was basically taken over by the worst British-influenced factions within China at the time of the so-called Cultural Revolution, and a few times before that as well. But Zhou Enlai stuck to the idea of science as the forefront and global collaboration as the forefront. And I think it's worth people thinking about this. And there's some very clear markers in history that demonstrate that this tendency existed even during the dark days of China's Maoist regime. Of course, it goes back to Sun Yat-sen, and we've discussed Sun Yat-sen on these calls many times. But I'll just mention a couple of things. Sun Yat-sen, who was the founder of the Chinese Republic, who largely led the revolution in 1911 that overthrew the imperial regimes and established a republic, was trained in Hawaii back in the 1880, 81, that time, when he was a young man, by Americans, people around a reverend there, Damon, who was steeped in the Philadelphia-centered American system school. So as a very young man, he studied Alexander Hamilton. He studied the idea of national banking. He studied the opponents of Hamilton around the Tories, but also around the Jeffersonians, who rejected Hamilton's idea of a credit system to generate industrialization. Jefferson, who wanted to remain an agricultural nation, and other problems. So that by the time of the revolution, even before the revolution, Sun Yat-sen had formulated his policy, which he called the Three Principles of the People, which were explicitly based, and you can read the text today, where he discusses in detail how the American system idea is the basis on which we overthrow empire once and for all. Not just overthrow the British, but to overthrow the idea of empire, be it any nation that's trying to impose imperial policies. And he explicitly called for using this directed credit through national banking. He tried to set up in a book he wrote called The Fundamentals of National Reconstruction. He said we need to industrialize and we need a national bank based on the principles of Alexander Hamilton. And the three principles themselves, you've probably heard this, were drawn directly from Abraham Lincoln in his Gettysburg Address when he said that we have to fight and we have fought and we have to defend this idea of this republic, this experiment in republican government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And Sun Yat-sen translated those into what he called the Sanminjui, the three principles of the people, which were the Minzu and the Minchuan and the Minsheng, being nationalism, i.e. government of the people, and a republican form of representative government, which he got from Lincoln's government by the people, and most importantly, the Minsheng, which is its equivalent to, it's sometimes called people's livelihood, but it's really the equivalent of our Declaration of Independence idea of the general welfare, that you are responsible for the general welfare of the population, assuring that people have livelihoods, that they're educated, they have access to their own creative potentials through education. And that this idea, of course, was Abraham Lincoln's government for the people. So this was the bedrock, and there were many, many problems. Sun Yat-sen was not able to consolidate the republic, and there were more wars and other problems. And then, of course, you ended up running into Japanese invasions and other things. And there were fights between the Communist Party and his party. At first, he was allied. Well, let me mention, when they had to fight a war against the warlords who basically under British input took over the revolution, so Sun became an enemy of the fake government, the warlord government. So he formed a military academy in Canton, Guangzhou, called the Whampoa Military Academy, which was headed by his close ally Chiang Kai-shek, who became later the head of Republican China and took the Republican.
If I'm not mistaken, Mike, didn't Zhou Enlai?
That's exactly what I was getting at. Yeah.
Okay.
Zhou Enlai was there. So this was done jointly between the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party, and the Communist Party. They were working hand in hand against imperialism, both foreign imperialism and the domestic tools of imperialism. And Zhou Enlai became a close friend, not only of Sun Yat-sen, but also of Chiang Kai-shek. Now, those of you who know this Chinese history know that there was hatred and fierce war between the nationalists and the communists, and the communists finally won in 1949 and drove the nationalists into Taiwan, where Chiang Kai-shek set up a national government there and prospered with American help. But throughout that time, Zhou Enlai and Chiang Kai-shek kept in close contact. Zhou Enlai, who represented to a certain real extent the American system within the communist movement, as opposed to the British faction, which had begun way back with Bertrand Russell when he went to China in 1920 and 21, and influenced Mao personally and other leaders on a British view of keeping backwards, of the peasant army, remaining peasant-based, excluding the rest of the world, isolating yourselves. So I'll give you one more key point on this in terms of what happened within the Chinese Communist Party era after 1949. In 1955, there was this incredibly important conference sponsored in Indonesia by Sukarno, who was the father of the Indonesian Republic, who led the war against the Dutch, who had to fight a war against the Dutch after World War II, because when Roosevelt died, Truman helped the British and the Dutch move their troops back into their colony. So they had more wars to fight. That's why we had Vietnam and so forth.
But this was the Bandung Conference,
The Bandung Conference in 1955. An extraordinary event. The first time that former colonialized countries met without their colonial lords there. It was Asian and African leaders. And the three key leaders of this were Nehru from India, Sukarno in Indonesia, and Zhou Enlai. And at that event, actually, Zhou Enlai, before the event, had worked out with Nehru something they called the Five Principles of Peaceful Coexistence. And this is very important because it really is the idea of Westphalia. It's the idea of a sovereign nation states brought up to date. And these five principles, the Pancasila, they're called in Indonesian. But it was the same basic categories: sovereignty of your nation, non-aggression, non-interference in each other's affairs, respecting the other's rights, the equality and mutual benefit for all sides, and peaceful coexistence. So these five principles were then introduced at the Bandung Conference as the basis for relations between nations. And I think it's extremely important to note that in opening this conference, Sukarno said, and this was in April of 1955, which was 180 years after the American Revolution in 75-76. And he, Sukarno actually quoted from Longfellow's poem about Paul Revere. He said this was almost exactly 100 years ago today. And he quoted a lot of it. But at the end, you know, he quotes, "A cry of defiance and not of fear, a voice in the darkness, a knock on the door, and a word that shall echo forevermore." This was when Paul Revere rallied the people to fight the British. And Sukarno said, after reading that, he said, "Yes, it shall echo forevermore. That battle, which began 180 years ago today, is not yet completely won." So this was very, very clear in their minds. And Zhou Enlai was a key part of this, that we had to make the American Revolution universal, not because America rules the world, but because the American system becomes dominant in the world, a system based on the true mutual interests of all people. So this, I mean, I think this gives you a sense. This is what was going on in China as well as elsewhere. In fact, you could say that the main purpose of that conference in the mind of Nehru, Sukarno, and Zhou Enlai was that they saw that the danger of America under the leadership of the Dulles brothers and others was heading for war with China. Not as much as we are today. We're on the brink. We were very close to war with China. China was being demonized. The communists were evil. They ate their children. They drank blood. You know, anything you could see in the Western press was demonizing China as totally sick, perverted people, and so on and so forth.
And this also, just to make the point in terms of the United States, was after the McCarthy period. But it was one of the keys to the McCarthy period was who lost China. The argument that there were Chinese communists supporters in the State Department and in U.S. politics, and that this was part of the whole creation of the Cold War mentality.
Yeah, absolutely. So this, you know, we were close to war, and they called that conference very consciously to show the world that Zhou Enlai was a brilliant, serious, moral person, and that you had to see that China, while it had problems and people had disagreements and so forth, was not some, you know, monster that was going to swallow the world. And among other things at this conference, Zhou Enlai said, "We will no longer," and there were cases of this, but they said, "We will no longer support communist revolutions within your country. That's not our purpose. I mean, we're not going to stop people who are communists who think they need to have a revolution or something. But we're not going to be, you know, basically trying to have regime change along our ideas." And this was a pledge that they upheld. So this is quite interesting. And then when China descended into chaos and hell with the Great Leap Forward and then the insanity of the Cultural Revolution, when you had, you had mobs of youth stirred up by the so-called Gang of Four that took over under Mao, who were raiding leadership, raiding universities, forcing students and professors to go out and work in the mud because the peasants are all supreme. They, when they began to attack the scientific institutions, Zhou Enlai stood up and was threatened with death himself by the mobs. But he stood up and absolutely defended China's scientific research and development, especially in nuclear power. And you may not know this, but the Russians had completely cut off the Chinese in about 1960. There was a China-Soviet split. So China was having to do this on their own, and they succeeded in building a bomb, which was extremely important for them to prevent that war from the United States. And they did it actually during the Cultural Revolution. So this was Zhou Enlai's work as well. And then, those of you who do remember, when Nixon and Kissinger opened up China, and they did this for their own reasons. They were trying to use China against Russia. But when they did open up China, it was Zhou Enlai who welcomed both Kissinger and Nixon in, and who basically represented that side of China coming out of the Cultural Revolution. He died. Oh, and by the way, in the Cultural Revolution, one of the main drivers of this was a anti-Confucius campaign. They were trying to destroy China's culture, not just Western culture. You were thrown in prison if you dared to play a violin. That was Western decadence. But also Chinese culture was being destroyed, and literally they waged what they called the anti-Confucius campaign. But in a real sense, that campaign was targeted against Zhou Enlai. He had to defend himself against being a person who supported culture. So, I mean,
when the Cultural Revolution was defeated, and Deng came in, Deng Xiaoping, he had been a collaborator with Zhou Enlai, right?
Right, right. Yeah, definitely.
So this is the beginnings, as you're talking about, this is not something new in China. This is a revival of that tradition that goes back to the beginning of the previous century with Sun Yat-sen.
Yeah, exactly. And a revival of the Confucian tradition, which, you know, from the very beginning, any of you who have read any of the material I wrote when I was in prison about Chinese and Western philosophy, the Confucian tradition was recognized by the great fathers of Western civilization, Leibniz, Nicholas of Cusa, even though he never knew the Chinese, his writing was coherent with that of the great Confucian scholars from the Song Dynasty. And when Leibniz literally personally was in correspondence with the missionaries who were over in China, he recognized immediately that the Chinese, through this Confucian tradition, had discovered the fundamental truths about mankind's role in the universe, what Leibniz called the monadology, the connection between the mind, the creative power of the human being, coherent with the laws of the universe as a whole, and that idea had been discovered in part by Confucius and Mencius, but really by the great 12th century Confucian Zhuxi, who had made these very, very profound discoveries, very much in keeping with Nicholas of Cusa's discoveries. So, you know, that whole long tradition of collaboration between truly moral human leaders in the West and in the East goes back to the very opening up of the first relations between modern Europe and modern China.
Now, just to bring this together with the theme we've been talking about for the last 15 minutes or so, this is something that is unknown to most Americans who still actually have the view of China that was the Cold War view, when the question of is there going to be an attack across the Straits of Kamoi and Matsu. You know, this is still the what Obama's playing on with the Asia pivot, is it not?
Well, yeah, definitely. It's the new aggressive power. You know, like the Wall Street Journal said, by trying to out-America America, they're trying to return to the empire of China, paying, you know, making countries pay homage to the great Chinese empire. Well, Helga has made the point several times that when you talk to these European and American leaders, you really get the sense that they are incapable of imagining anybody who thinks in other than geostrategic terms. Anyone who really thinks that their personal purpose and the purpose of their nation should be for the betterment of mankind as a whole. That, to them, is impossible. Why? Because they don't think human beings are human. They right. think people are animals. They reject everything that the every great scientist, with Vernadsky being the most advanced, locates as that which distinguishes us from beasts, which is that we are not subject to punishment and reward, animal training. We're not just out for physical pleasure. We take joy, and this is what Leibniz meant when he gave us in our Declaration of Independence the idea of the pursuit of happiness. That happiness doesn't mean, you know, eating good food and having good sex. You know, it comes from the joy of creativity, the joy of actually having that experience of the mind, creating something new, something that's never existed, or experiencing that through great art, through great music. That experience in the mind that uplifts and brings about tears of joy, and which truly makes us feel like we're doing something that will be eternal, that gives us eternal life, because it's something that will contribute to the future of mankind.
Well, you know, last week I talked with Helga because on the LaRue show because of the commemoration of the 255th birthday of Schiller, and also the 30th anniversary of the creation of the Schiller Institute. And one of the points that she kept making is that Schiller's idea is that the most noble human being is the person who is happy doing their duty, that it becomes something that's not an onerous task, but something you want to do, and you take joy in. And if you look at the difference between that and the dominant mentality in the United States today, and I'll pick an example of that with the hardcore right-wing fundamentalists, who actually think that in order to be good and get to heaven, they have to suppress their natural instinct to be greedy, to seek sex and to seek pleasure. And they can't be happy by doing the good. And I think that it's really important for people to see what Helga has been getting at for years, which is that this is the principle not of individual morality, but of statecraft. And it seems to me that this is exactly what Xi is exemplifying with his interventions of this last week. Hmm.
There's no question but that the Chinese people, I did travel with Helga to China in February, and she's been there once since with Bill Jones. And there's no question but that there is a level of excitement, of optimism in China. And when you speak to people, they're very, very aware and concerned about the danger of war and the danger of disaster. But when you talk to them about what they're doing with the Silk Road, with their water projects, with their landing on the moon, they have this sense of course, we're human beings. Or they may say we're Chinese, but what they mean is that we're being human. This is joyful. And that's what we're about. That's what our lives are about. That's what our country is about. Now, of course, they have problems there. This is not a heavenly happy nation. There are big problems, but most of them are coming from the outside because people are susceptible to imperial thinking, to color revolutions, to appealing to your sense perceptions rather than your mind. But they, as a nation, have gone through a true transformation, a truly revolutionary process, and one which they are anxious to spread to the world, to the United States. They're anxious to see the United States, from which they took this inspiration historically, to see it restored. And I can assure you that they are extremely aware that the LaRouche movement is really their only hope. And in that sense, by the way, I'll say that the cover of this report that we're releasing, and you can buy this report for $250 or together with a daily alert we've started for $500 to start it. But the cover is going to be, I think, four pictures. One of the ITAR fusion reactor, one of a maglev train, one of the Three Gorges Dam in China, and at the very top, a picture of the U-2 Chinese lander on the moon with a little Chinese flag on it. And if you take this and you go to your friends and associates and say you have to buy this and master this yourself, this is what the human race can do, what you have on that cover, you can say, look, America's doing none of this. We're not doing water projects. We never did NAWAPA. We're not going to space anymore. We scuttled our space program. We're not building high-speed rail. They have 18,000 kilometers of high-speed rail and maglev in China. We have none, no high-speed rail, let alone maglev. And we're doing some fusion. It's the one thing that at least some of our scientists are allowed to work on, thank God. But, you know, by and large, we're doing none
of
these things.
But that's under attack also by the Obama administration. They're not getting funded. I mean, this is really a crucial point because, you know, you get Americans who have a feeling of patriotism and nationalism, but it's been misplaced because if you look at the examples you just gave, while China's engaging in these water projects, we have killer drought from the area of central Texas all the way out to the Pacific Ocean, destroying some of our most important farmland. You talk about the Chinese space program. We've had, in the last 2 weeks, two private rockets, you know, that we no longer have NASA, so we have these private, well, we have NASA, but it's not being utilized. We have these private companies developing rockets for space tourism, in the case of Virgin, whatever it's called. They crashed. So we should have, as Americans, a real humble sense that we created a model that we've drifted away from and is now being almost outlawed in the United States, but others have seen the benefit of it. And I think we have to make the point, and I'm glad you went through what's in the cover because it's really important, for Americans to see that the Chinese are not just making gains because of slave labor or industrial espionage, but that they have actually mastered a whole approach, even with all the problems they have, to getting into the future with new technology, innovation, engineering projects, and so on.
And a massive, massive education program, sending their students all over the world. It's been pointed out that when they came out of this disaster of the Cultural Revolution, they accepted the U.S. coming in and they allowed the U.S. to set up these factories. It was probably a mistake, all for export and so forth. But their thinking was, we can't do it ourselves right now because we've so destroyed ourselves. We have to send our people all over the world for education. And they did. They sent people to Russia, to the U.S., to the U.K., to Australia, to Germany. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people. So one generation later, these people came back, and they came back with optimism and with a sense of wanting to contribute, not just learning business. You know, what do people study in the West these days? Business. Well, these Chinese studied science, right? They weren't out to make a quick buck. And there's people in China making a big buck. That's actually a bit of a problem. But what they came back with was what is now one of the best scientific cores in the world, and they are making use of it not only for themselves, but for the benefit of the whole world.
Well, Mike, we're down to the last couple of minutes, and I think it would be important to reiterate this contrast that Lyndon LaRouche discussed today between the great potential that you've been discussing of China, but also the immediacy of the danger if Obama is not removed, because that's what people should come out of this program today with, a sense to be a part of this bold adventure into a new future, as opposed to sticking with what we already know is leading us toward war and destruction. So, you know, just if you want to summarize it from that standpoint, I think that's very important.
It's what you mentioned earlier, or maybe it was before the call. You know, people are being told, oh, the Republicans won, so now they can do the pipeline and they can fight immigration. These issues are meaningless. I mean, there's some impact to them, but what difference does it make if we're in World War III? What difference does it make if our economy is being crushed that we're selling some oil from Canada, as a matter of fact? You know, what are the Republicans doing? They're fracking, something that is economically a waste, destructive of our water system when we have massive water shortage. Their idea is quick-term bucks. How can we make some fancy bucks by speculation and by the most backward forms of energy and other kinds of development? So don't get trapped into these phony debates that you see in the newspapers of how there's going to be a fight between Obama and the Congress. The issue of Obama acting as a dictator is the key, and he has to be stopped. He's a criminal. He has to be removed. And if we are going to not have a fascist war under Republican leadership, we have to have Obama out now and restructure the Democratic Party, work with our close friends in the Republican Party like Walter Jones, to create a bipartisan force capable of restoring the American system in collaboration with our natural allies, Russia, China, and India, and others, but those three great nations in particular who are basing themselves on the American system and that we have to restore here.
And maybe we can save Germany on the side.
It would be good.
Yeah.
Get rid of the witch of Europe.
Yes. One of Obama's few friends.
Yeah, right.
So, Mike, thank you for joining us. I hope people have been enlightened by this and will understand the importance of digging deeper, because in a one-hour program, you can't really get into the depth. But we have that in our new report, which is available through Executive Intelligence Review, through your contacts in the LaRouche Movement. And I would urge people to buy two of them, one for yourself, one for your congressman. Actually, buy three. Give it to your significant other for Christmas. There's nothing more important than you can do to make sure there's a future. So, Mike, thanks for joining us, and I'm sure we'll have you back on again sometime soon.
Thanks, Arlie.
Okay, that's it for the LaRouche Show for this week, and we'll be back next week, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for our weekly program. Goodbye.